Welcome to Discovering and Sharing Shuswap History.
This story is published in the Okanagan Historical Reports, and it was written recording memories of Rolly Jameson in 1927. The warm sun had persuaded most of the people walking to church to remove their coats until they entered the church. They were gathered in front of their place of worship, relishing a few minutes of visiting. All agreed it was a fine day, not a bit like fall, as they donned their coats before entering the church and finding a place in the wooden pews. There was a large hand-pump organ at the center of the back wall on the platform at the back of the church. The pulpit was to the left, and at the front of the stage, directly above the large heating floor register connected to an oversized wood-burning furnace in the basement, the choir chairs were arranged to the right, adjacent to the three steps from the main floor and leading up to the door to the cloakrooms and kitchen. From there, a long flight of stairs led to the basement and the outside entrance. To the left, at the foot of the stairs, were two Sunday school classrooms and another door to the furnace room, where there was a large supply of dry wood neatly piled by the caretaker. Frank Bonneman worked as the auctioneer's clerk and owned the second-hand store, which was maintained in a very orderly manner. He was also the Presbyterian church caretaker and was always prepared for winter with a large supply of kindling and old papers stored in the safe place. The matches were stored in a yellow can formerly filled with McDonald's cut-plug chewing tobacco. The can was placed on a beam that could only be reached by standing on a chair. The furnace was set, ready for the first cold morning. The wood was piled in a teepee in the firebox. Mrs. Pickering was the organist and never missed a Sunday. She always arrived first, accompanied by her grandson Herbie, who was the regular organ pumper. The pumper was hidden behind a movable screen beside the organ pump handle at the right near the choir. There was a single chair behind the screen for the pumper to use between hymns. It was very important to maintain a constant air pressure to the organ bellows concealed in the lower section. Mrs. Pickering was an excellent musician and a strict disciplinarian with the choir and the organ pumper. Herbie and Rolly were classmates and good friends, so when he was laid up with a cold one Sunday, his grandmother asked Rolly to pump the organ. However, she didn't believe that Herbie would stay inside on such a fine day, and since neither family had a telephone, there were two organ pumpers behind the screen. The church members were in place. Mrs. Pickering was busy with last-minute instructions to the choir, who were missing two tenors. They'd gone fishing. The small congregation was always short of funds and not able to sustain a full-time minister for any great length of time. It was an irregular procession of theology students and retired ministers who filled the role of minister. That day it was Reverend F. Dingle, B.A.D.D., who would be preaching. He'd been in Salmon Arm a few months, and there had been whispers in the tea and cookie circles that the Reverend was not an ordained minister, and the several couples who had been married by him were no doubt living in sin. The Reverend may have heard about the unfounded gossip, said to have been started by an unhappy wife of a clergyman from another denomination. And so it was on this beautiful sunny day that the text of the sermon was from Proverbs 5:3-5. For the lips of a strange woman drop as a honeycomb, and her mouth is smoother than oil, but her end is bitter as wormwood, sharp as a two-edged sword. Her feet go down to death, her steps take hold on hell. The Reverend Dingle was at his very best when he met the devil and the fires of hell head on. His audience sat in a cold sweat. Some were transfixed. Prior to the sermon, and just after the children's hymn of Jesus Loves Me, Herbie and Rolly had a brief scuffle, trying to be the first for the chair. They broke the chair and knocked over the screen and were in full view of the congregation. The Reverend Dingle glared at them and suggested that one of them should leave. An embarrassed Mrs. Pickering told Herbie to stay where he was. Rolly turned to leave, tripping over the broken chair. With a flaming face, he hurried across the platform in front of the choir and stunned congregation to the kitchen door and that long flight of stairs to freedom. His footsteps sounded like echoing thunder. Partway down the stairs, a cold chill possessed him, and he was committed to the power of the devil. He placed Mr. Bonneman's chair so he could reach the matches and the yellow can on the beam. His heart was pounding at a furious rate as he opened the furnace door and lit the fire. He left the basement by the back door and ran across Harris Street to the safety of a large pile of cordwood behind the school. Herbie knew where to find Rolly. After church, he came over and told him the rest of the events of the morning. He had picked up the fallen screen and borrowed an empty chair from the choir and sat down. He noticed that his grandmother was bent over the organ keys. He was not sure if she was crying or laughing. Tears were streaming down her cheeks, and her shoulders were shaking. By now, the Reverend Dingle had started to sweat as the church became very warm. He stopped his sermon to ask someone to open the window. There were 8 windows, and each of them had 2 volunteers who struggled briefly, but to no avail. The church had been painted several times since it was built in 1912, and the windows were included in the paint job. They refused to budge. 3 men then tried on one window and managed to break a lower pane with a loud shattering of splintering glass. Fortunately, there was no loss of blood. There seemed to be no relief from the mounting temperature. Opening the front door let in the heat from the near-noon sun. By then, the Reverend Dingle appeared to have wilted. His voice had been reduced to an inaudible whisper. As the sweat dripped from his chin, the fury of the fires of hell became a reality. Herbie had a grin on his face when he told Rowley, "The minister mentioned your name, asking forgiveness for the wayward young boy in the closing prayer." It was not long before Rowley's parents were informed of the morning's events at the church, and he spent the rest of the day in his bedroom reading Huckleberry Finn. And he's sure that he heard the sound of laughter from the dining room downstairs. This story takes place on the 24th of May, when Rowley Jameson was 14 years old. He was in the back seat of Mr. Ray Corning's Star touring car going to Celista. Rowley was friends with Corning's son Rex. The weather was warm, and all got out to stretch their legs. Mr. Corning was working as the Provincial Public Works District Engineer, and he inspected bridges and roads. He parked his car beside others in a field where a baseball diamond was ready for the afternoon game. Celista was hosting the team from Salmon Arm. Mrs. Corning packed an ample and tasty lunch, which the family enjoyed under a large shade tree. After lunch, Mr. Corning was carefully driving down a long hill. Suddenly, there was a long blast on a horn, loud bangs on the side of a car. A careening old Dodge touring car rushed by the Corning vehicle at an alarming speed as Mr. Corning anticipated enough passing room for the fast-moving car. Teddy Wirtz was at the wheel with a cigar clenched in his mouth and looking straight ahead. Eddie Barr and Nelson Stevie were the 2 ball players banging on the outside of the car. The swaying car disappeared in a cloud of dust and flying rocks. Mr. Corning thought there must have been something wrong with the car to be going at such a reckless speed. After a few minutes, they noticed the car off to the side of the road at the bottom of the hill. Mr. Corning pulled up beside the overheated car and asked if he could be of any help. Teddy Wirtz came over and apologized for the incident, explaining that he had lost his brakes and thought he could get home all right now. Wirtz was the butcher at Palmer's Butcher Shop on Front Street in town. He was a sports fan, and he was the manager of the Salmon Arm Baseball Club. The 4 ball players were walking around with a cold sweat showing on their faces and not talking very much. The Cornings forgot to ask about the game, as the escape from what might have been a serious accident was foremost in their minds. The next trip Jameson made to the North Shore was 4 years later in 1934. He was 18. Howard Doig, the minister at the Presbyterian Church on Harris Street, had lent his 1929 Ford Model A to Jim Brewster, a licensed driver who asked his friends Harold Malone, George Kinsey, Herbie Pickering, and Rowley Jameson to attend the opening of the Celista Hall. They arrived at the hall soon after 9 o'clock after waiting their turn to board the Sorrento Scotch Creek Ferry, which was having a busy night. Captain Poole told the Brewster Road that he would be running extra trips until 1 o'clock, ending at the Sorrento Landing. The hall was full of dancing couples, with many sitting on the benches along the side of the walls. The Salmon Arm carload stood watching for a while, but could not resist the lively music of the Noakes Family Orchestra. Rowley Jameson asked a young lady who appeared to be alone if she cared to dance with him. She looked over towards the open door and then said, "Yes." The orchestra was playing a slow waltz, and Rowley and his partner danced well together. The crowd applauded for several encores, and when the dance was finished, Rolly took his quiet partner to where she had been standing and asked if he might have another dance later on. She smiled and nodded her head. The hall was quite warm and many couples went outside into the cool night air. Rolly went out to find his friends, but they were not in sight at the time. It was very dark beyond the glow of the lamps through the open doorway. Suddenly a tall man appeared from out of the darkness and spoke to Rolly. "Was that you dancing with my girl? Why were you dancing with her?" Rolly must have given the boyfriend an answer because he mumbled, "She won't talk to me." By then Harold and George had joined Rolly and the unhappy lover. The lovebird cheered up and asked everyone to have a beer. The salmon armors followed him through the trees until they came to a small stream where he had cached his beer. He fished out a bottle for each of them, explaining, "I made this brew myself," and he opened a bottle for Rolly. The beer erupted like a foaming geyser, covering Rolly in his new gray suit with a powerful-smelling, unbridled concoction. Everyone except Rolly had a good laugh. A thought crossed Rolly's mind that this amateur brewmaster did not want him dancing with his girlfriend again. The others opened their bottles a little more cautiously and quickly put the foaming bottle to their mouths to capture the fast-flowing flood of fermented fluid. Rolly removed his saturated coat and placed it in the car and opened the windows, hoping the fresh air would remove the smell. By the time Rolly returned to the hall, the orchestra was playing a supper waltz, and on the last note, the fiddle player quickly reached under his chair and pulled out a finger-handled jug. With practiced dexterity, swung it to his forearm and elbow to enjoy a long, gratifying swig. The hall committee provided an excellent supper intermission, while some of the parents put their small sleeping children onto blankets and bearskins in the corner of the hall. Dancing continued until the first light of day. The sleeping children were carried gently out to cars and wagons, where horses had waited patiently for their owners to head home. Barn lanterns were lit and hung at the rear of the wagons as a warning to approaching cars. Pass with caution. Rolly did not get another chance to dance with the quiet young lady, as she and her boyfriend had reconciled their differences and danced together for the rest of the night. Rolly and the salmon arm contingency stayed until the dance ended and took the long way home via the recently constructed Squilats Bridge. Young Maddie Carroll, his siblings and parents, arrived looking for a new start. Winnipeg had been easy to leave. Salmon Arm was booming, and so was business. Maddie's father set up shop, associating himself with Misters Warren and Ruth, where they sold furniture insurance and were the undertakers. It was a dynamic combination. New houses were being constructed, and everyone needed furniture. Fires were common. Everyone needed house insurance, and no one lived forever. Record has it that Mr. Ruth was the first undertaker. He likely trained Maddie's father and eventually sold the senior Carol the entire operation. Maddie took over the family business. Like his father, Maddie saw strength in business diversity. Some call him the Jimmy Pattison of Salmon Arm. He operated the Rex Theater, had a plumbing and sheet metal shop, and continued with the undertaking business. He was police commissioner for many years and served as alderman. Old-timer Rolly Jameson worked for Maddie Carroll as a teenager and described him as a short man with a quick-tempered way who was fair, kind-hearted, and community-minded. Jameson had many stories to tell about the development of the Rex Theater in Salmon Arm. The theater was at street level at the corner of Hudson and Alexander. Moving pictures, accompanied by Mrs. Bavar on the piano, were biweekly events. Rolly, when he wasn't working in the plumbing business, kept the theater clean on Thursdays and Saturdays. The Empress, the hall above the Rex, was rented by the Social and Dramatic Club for plays and dances every Friday winter night. Rolly and three other men carried Mrs. Bavar's piano from the Rex Theater to the Empress up two flights of stairs for the Social and Dramatic Club dances, but not before two 6x6 support posts were put into concrete blocks, bracing the Rex's ceiling to support the weak trusses on the second floor. The post had to be removed the next movie night. Had Salmon Arm had a building inspector, he would have been shocked. Not only did Rolly and his pals pack the piano, he hauled 6 pails of water for the evening's dishes, split and packed wood for the stove. Luckily, the drain in the kitchen was connected to the drugstore next door, so the water was not hauled down again, but Rolly had the privilege of taking the contents of the chemical toilet up and down a ladder that was in the back. He climbed the ladder, going across the roof to the drugstore and down to the Rex Theater below. Although Rowley was a faithful employee, when Maddie approached him to take over the undertaking business, he found it an easy offer to reject. Rowley had helped the undertaker before, but it wasn't something he enjoyed. Rowley had been spooked when assisting Maddie Carroll after the accidental death of a Sikkimus man who'd been caught in a forest fire. The body had to be shipped for burial according to strict CPR rules. A sealed liner was made out of metal to fit in the casket. Rowley was left to solder the lid on. He didn't get the job done because it was movie night at the Rex. After the show got started, Maddie took over the projectionist duties and sent Rowley back down to the shop that didn't have an electricity to seal the body in. Rowley set up candles beside the coffin and set to soldering. It was in that atmosphere, with the shadows moving up and down the wall, that determined Rowley's abridged career. In 1947, Maddie retired. Rowley bought the plumbing and heating business, and a newcomer, Thomas Bowers, bought the funeral home. Maddie moved to Vancouver, and 5 years later, he died. Rowley Jameson moved to Salmon Arm in 1924. He'd moved from Revelstoke and had been enrolled in the Cubs there, and when he came to Salmon Arm, his parents enrolled him again. The Cubs met at Old City Hall, where the apartment building is on Shuswap Street. It was a little building set back on the street. A wooden sidewalk led to the front door. A flagpole graced the front of the building. Up two steps, and there was an entry to the front office, which went through to the council chambers and two jail cells. Court was also held there. Rex Lingford, the municipal clerk, had an office around the back, and as head administrator he raided his own sidewalk. Most people headed straight to his office around back, but some people went into the City Hall building, through all the rooms, to Lingford's lean-to in the rear. The building met many needs. The Girl Guides and Cubs met there weekly, but not on the same nights, of course. Rowley's introduction to the Cub group was gruesome. Other Cubs initiated him with the story of a man who hanged himself in cells. They told vivid details on Rowley's first night. His young eyes were shown the very cell where the hanging occurred. One meeting had an extra guest. Someone picked up for drunken disorder. Cub leader hung a blanket in front of the cell. The inmate kept quiet, and the meeting went on to the quiet snores of the contented prisoner. Rowley must have listened for every breath. On certain days, the City Hall was also busy with court proceedings. Magistrate Booth heard trials. Rowley remembered one trial he had more than an active interest in. He was in grade 8. There had been a fierce snow battle outside. The boys had built forts just outside the school grounds and threw snowballs at each other. One boy was injured in the eye. His mother decided that if the principal wasn't going to step in, she'd file a civil complaint. Mum filed a charge against Willie Paderny for throwing a snowball with a rock in it. With the amount of fighting that was going on, Rowley didn't know how anyone could tell who threw the ball. Paderny and the plaintiff, unnamed in this story to protect the innocent boy from his mother, were taken over to City Hall for trial. It must have been a slow day for Magistrate Booth. Court was in session, but he agreed to hear the pressing matter almost immediately afterwards. Mr. Prescott, the schoolteacher, was asked to send over a witness to the fight. He turned to Herbie Pickering and Rowley and said, "You two aren't paying much attention to class. You might as well go over to court." The court got two inattentive witnesses. I guess in Rowley and Herbie's minds they were the star witnesses, but neither knew if he was appearing for the prosecution or the defense, and they were never to find out. The trial ahead of Paderny's continued. The boys had to wait. Mr. Lingford had the other role, of course. He was the court clerk, and he wouldn't let them sit through the other matter. Maybe the content wasn't appropriate. Lingford was also the Sunday school warden at the Anglican church down the street. Lingford told them to wait in his office. He locked them in. It was a comfortable winter day. A coal-fired pot-belly stove warmed the boys. After what seemed a long time, the boys began to listen to another call. They wanted relief and banged on the door to the courtroom. They told Rex Lingford they wanted to go out to the outhouse out back. "You can't leave here because you'll run away," Rex replied. He knew boys, and especially these two. "You've got to stay until the trial is over." He shut the door and left the two to their own devices. They were desperate. All they could think about was immediate relief. Eventually they figured out a plan. These boys were practical, if not studious. They opened the lid to the stove and responded to nature's call. The fumes were so bad almost immediately that our heroes laid down on the floor at the back of the room and breathe through their mouths. Eventually, the other court case concluded and the boys were called in. When Linkford opened the door to his office, the smell was overpowering. Magistrate Booth dismissed the court and had the building cleared. The case of the snowball and the unfortunate one-eyed, anonymous victim never came to trial. It was, as Rowley puts it, an episode. But that wasn't the only episode for Willie Padurney. His bad luck was to continue. One day his father was helping out at the cemetery, digging a grave, and Mrs. Padurney got his lunch ready. Willie must have been out of school because he was told to take his dad's lunch out to the cemetery. Willie was smart. He went directly to the cemetery. But smarter still, he didn't go directly home. Willie went into the cemetery tool shed, filled with all sorts of implements and explosives. He started playing with some of the dynamite caps. Willie's fiddling around set off the caps, and he blew two of his fingers off and part of his thumb. Mr. Padurney Sr. didn't want to have anything to do with his son's injuries. He was furious. Now, Willie was bleeding pretty badly. People in the neighborhood heard the explosion and called into town. The mayor, who was also the taxi driver, got hold of a policeman and they loaded their guns. They feared someone had been shot. They headed out of town in the taxi, guns in hand, and found Willie bleeding pretty badly. They took him to the hospital and Willie's dad was still mad. Willie's hand cured eventually and he left home to live in a camp somewhere, escaping school lessons and his father's wrath forever. As Mary Harrington said, that Willie just had a string of bad luck, losing several parts of his body.
My name is Dorothy Rolin. I'm the current president of the Salmon Arm branch of the Okanagan Historical Society. If you have stories or memories you'd like to share with this program, please call Voice of the Shuswap at 250-463-5026. Or email info@voiceoftheshuswap.ca. Discovering and sharing Shuswap history.
This radio program was made possible by a Government of Canada New Horizons grant, helping celebrate Canada's 150th anniversary.